All I would note concerning the reservation is that in 1971, with the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the Noorvik Reserve was terminated, and it now no longer exists. I think I'll reverse the order on this next one and talk next about Project Chariot, which was an Army Corps of Engineer program which would have greatly altered the character of the land and the people of the region's management over the land had it succeeded. By way of background, in the late 1940s, the Soviet Union detonated a nuclear weapon. And the U.S. reaction to that, other than more than a little concern, was that what we need to do, that is, we need to establish that our nuclear bombs are good bombs as opposed to the Soviet Union's nuclear devices, which are bad bombs. And so they set up something called Operation Plowshare. And Operation Plowshare sought to find peaceful, useful purposes for the United States' nuclear arsenal. They looked at creating tunnels, doing some mining, perhaps with nuclear devices. They looked at the possibility of creating artificial harbors in various places in the world. And one of the places that they identified for the creation of an artificial harbor by using nuclear weapons was between Kivalina and Point Hope at a place called Cape Thompson. The reason for that location was that people were aware of the oil deposits in the proximity of the North Slope area, and also were aware of the mineral potentials in the area that's where the Red Dog Mine is located. Aware of those, the economic benefits of pulling minerals from Northwest Alaska, and seeing that there was no deep water port available, the Army Corps of Engineers proposed to detonate five nuclear devices of 5 megatons each. This would create an instant artificial harbor, and there was no question that it would create that hole, sizable hole. But there was some question as to how the radioactive substances and byproducts would affect the region. So taking a look at the prevailing winds involved, the Army Corps of Engineers recommended that the following communities be evacuated prior to the detonation. That would have been Point Hope, Kivalina, Noatak, Noorvik, Kayana, Kotzebue, possibility of Selawik. And there were possibility of another number of other regions or communities within the region. All of these villages, the peoples of these villages, would have been relocated to Nome, the idea being that it would be easier to supply them with goods and housing and compensation for removing the people from the land, and that it would centralize the BIA's efforts in directing and changing the lifestyle of the people. In response to this, there was no great outcry in the lower 48. Conservationists were probably still driving Buicks to drive-ins. I mean, it just wasn't a national issue. Conservationism, concern for the ecology, for the environment. Speaking of the late 1940s and 50s when this was occurring, just didn't exist, you know, in any significant degree. The people of the Nana region and also the people of the North Slope area reacted very strongly, however, to this proposal. One of the outcomes of Project Chariot was the establishment of a newspaper which would voice the Alaska Native side of political issues, and that came to be called the Tundra Times, under the direction of Howard Rock, a Point Hope resident. The second outcome of Project Chariot. The reaction to that was that Alaska Native people in the Nana region saw that it was important that we organize politically, that there be an organization which would address these political issues which were going to affect the region. And finally, I think it showed a renewed concern for protecting and looking out over the land of the Nana region. People, of course, were eventually successful, and it was very close, but they were eventually successful in preventing the Army Corps of Engineers carrying out Project Chariot. Ironically, what occurred then was, having protected the land, the people of the Nana region, in 1980, the park systems were established as a part of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. These park systems, under control of the federal government, now protect the land from its former protectors, among other people. The land protection of the federal government is carried out at a national level, in which I think we will see a continuing concern by the people of the Nana region that lands which the people of the Nana region had protected and had established ownership over for thousands of years, they now have only an advisory capacity over at best. And in the future, no doubt we'll see increasing federal regulations brought about through the park system, which will have a direct impact on the lifestyle of the people of the Nana region. But this is an issue, I think, which will have increasing importance into the future, and we'll probably devote a section of our last program, Future Issues of the Nana Region, specifically to this question. What I'd like to note now is that the area of community control. In the area of community control, what we see is that traditionally the people had always had self-government. And before outsiders ever came into the region, the people were governing themselves. Each group of people had its own source of government, its own system, sometimes very informal, sometimes more structured, but it was there. In the 1930s, the federal government came in with the Indian Reorganization Act. And what the government was not reorganizing was, the government was not reorganizing Indians. Rather, it was reorganizing the way it was going to deal with Indian governments, with Native governments. And that's what IRAs mean. And it's just another term for the traditional councils, or the TCs. The government decided that it was in the best interest of both itself and the people that the traditional councils represented to recognize those governments and deal with them. I would only note this time that the power of the IRA TCs is not power granted by the state or the federal government, but according to law, it's powers which are inherent as a self-governing people. These powers are include the right to oversee the disposition of Native lands. The state of Alaska in the 1950s established municipalities, attempted to establish municipalities through most of rural Alaska. Municipalities provided access to some increasing state funds and revenues, and so they increased throughout rural Alaska. That was a positive aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that the municipalities, for the first time, brought a competing source of government in which, for the first time in the Nana region, governments were not solely Native controlled, at least on the local level. In the municipality system, it's an open ticket to whoever's in the region. It should also be noted that municipalities were often supplanting the self-governing powers of the IRATCs, particularly in the Kotzebue area. Now, at this time, I'd like to break it open. I know we're still running through this information rather quickly, but I think it's worthwhile to at least note the government agencies in this program, and then we'll follow it, this program, with an additional bibliography to go with your the INUPAC Studies bibliography that you already have, which was sent to you before. Are there any questions over what we've covered? Say, Terry and Noatak?
Well, I'm not real clear what the IRAs are. Maybe you could explain that one more time.
All right. Nobody's quite clear as to what the IRAs are. That's one of the questions that hasn't been dealt with legally in the state of Alaska. Basically, though, the IRAs are seen as they're local governments, which are the representation of the traditional governments of the people of the regions. So their power base is the traditional powers of government that the people had in former times. They're seen as basically the you would call it the tribal government or the Mu'it government of each area. They have powers which include, at least in their constitution, control over the disposition of native lands. In other words, they can approve or disapprove the sale or transfer of lands within their area of jurisdiction. Of course, the question is that where is their area of jurisdiction? That hasn't been established yet, at least in Alaska. So perhaps that'll at least point out what we do know and indicate that there are large gaps. Did that help, Terry? Maybe
that's
not.
That's better, thanks.
Oh, all right. How about Mike and Norvik? Any questions?
Yeah, Paul, I was wondering, since Norvik at one time had a legal identification that was unique, if it still has any ramifications of that in the present time. I know that a lot is being discussed and disputed, but if there's any effects still flowing into Norvik government and the issues of government planning and buried land control over finances, which are the results of Norvik once having been a reserve?
I think the effect of having been a reserve on Norvik, from a legal standpoint, is pretty much eliminated. The effect is a psychological one. Being aware of the fact that they were formerly a reserve, people were formerly a reserve, might change the way the people feel about land control and protection. Norvik, because of its reserve status, had a much stronger protection over the limited area that the reserve covered. The reason why Norvik went with the village corporation system that it did, first of all, it was required to by the Land Claims Act. The only thing that the Norvik was given was what type of village corporation would it want. And we'll go into that more next week when we talk about the Land Claims Act itself. But Norvik, I think the Land Claims Act pretty much eliminated the legal legacy of the reserve system for the community. It's a good question. You know, it's a good question. Did we follow that enough, or?
Yes, that was good. Thanks, Paul.
All right. How about Chuck and Selwick?
One question that has come up within the student population here is the subsistence economy, where even as late as the 1930s, 1940s, people were living at traditional campsites for the majority of the year. And when municipalities and the formal educational system began to come in, it actually brought people in for much longer periods of time in larger groups, whereas the traditional lifestyles and educational process that had gone on for long periods of time was supplanted. I was wondering if there was any data to the actual kind of identification of educational processes that were done and kind of sequence or levels that were done in the subsistence camps at different times.
What sort of educational system was going on in the camps?
Right, because basically kids were learning all the skills they needed to subsist in those camps, and, even people my age, say 35, many of those did not come into the camps for year-round school until they were 8, 9 years old. And there was a broad-based education on the land, so to speak, already in place before the advent of the BIA and the other formal school systems coming in.
And should be noted that this is what we're dealing with, and this is, I think you're bringing up a good point, is that when we're talking about the educational system, we're talking about the formal written system. But that always what we've seen occur is that there's been the traditional educational system, which is to varying degrees has been working sometimes with and many times against the formal program. Whereas a formal program would require all-day attendance 180 days a year, the informal and very important traditional system would say, no, what we need are skills concerning land use, traditional hunting skills, certain subsistence skills, which are best taught in the field by somebody who's an expert in that area. And so what we've seen is that in spite of this system, many times, occasionally in cooperation with that informal subsistence education has gone on. But often it was at odds with these systems. It's just one of those issues that's reoccurring. You know, what are you training your students towards? And if you're training them towards living within the region, then does a formal system itself provide all the educational needs for the students, you know, if they're going to be living in the region, or are there other things that they need to be taught through the through traditional methods? And it's probably a combination that would be, you know, some combination is what's necessary. All right. Question, Olaf in Chungnak.
Yeah, I have one, Paul, relating to education, but it's rather convoluted, and I'll wait till a later time. Thank you.
All right. A good man. Good man. All right. Marion, Kiana, any questions?
It seems as though there's been a lot of trouble getting the land surveyed. Is that just a physical problem, or is politics again rearing its head?
Who are we to know? We are mere checker players on the board of life, and there are many people who are playing chess with the same pieces. I think there are just basic logistical problems. I mean, we're looking at huge tracts of land that would require easily billions of dollars to do complete surveys, and the government hasn't been providing billions of dollars for surveying in Alaska. I think we're looking at a long-term process before we see any reliable surveys throughout the rural areas. Any other questions? Anybody that we might have missed?
Paul, this is Sally in Ambler. I have a real quick question.
Sure.
How do the IRAs get funding?
By hook or by crook? No. Actually, the IRAs have priority on certain categories of funding. They actually, by law, have preference over the REAAs on JOM monies then. Or federal monies, the level of priorities being the IRAs, and then I believe the nonprofit regionals, and then I believe it's the REAAs for control over JOMIA monies. Don't hold me to that. I think that's how that works. So that's where they would get some monies. Other monies come from tribal assistance acts, which the federal government through the BIA provides funding for administrative programming and assistance. There are other line item grants and federal programs which are directed towards tribal governments, and that's where the IRA traditional councils pick up the majority of their funding. Comes from that relationship with the federal government. Well, I think, unless are there any other questions? If not, I'd...
Paul, Conrad.
Yes, sure.
I have a question. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot for the future. Do you foresee any smaller REAAs, any smaller groups of people developing school districts, something like Nome has done and possibly other Class A cities, where the rural control would be in a smaller group of people?
The question is, do we anticipate smaller areas of local control than the present REAAs?
Right.
I see that happening more in other regions. There's one REAA that I just came from with, which has over 30, I think, 29 or 30 sites within their educational attendance area. It doesn't strike me as a school district when I'm there. It strikes me more like visiting Europe or perhaps the Balkans. You know, it's so diverse and varied. So, you know, from the standpoint of program efficiency and local input, you would think that smaller REAs would be desirable. I think what's going to work against that, what would work against that, is the fact of cost, because every time you start another REAA, you get administrative overhead and more cost per student. And that's in reverse to the tide that the state of Alaska is moving into, which is holding down on the cost of virtually everything, including education. I think I've now got less than 5 minutes to get through Marine Mammal Act, medical care, and regional control. What I'd like to do is just briefly mention each one of those and how they've affected the region. Once again, we're just highlighting these areas, and let's do that. Marine Mammal Protection Act, which was passed in 1972, the most direct impact that it had on the history of the region was that it stopped the commercial sport or trophy hunting of polar bears in the region, killing or stopping a major source of income for particularly the Kotzebue community. Stopping that, the Marine Mammal Protection Act did provide, after considerable lobbying and political efforts on the part of Alaska Natives, the Marine Mammal Act provided for the continued subsistence use of marine mammals. Very, very carefully defined definitions as to what would constitute traditional and subsistence use. The state of Alaska, we just briefly mentioned, wants to retake over, or is looking at retaking, the control of certain marine mammals. And that's one of the issues that we're looking at now, and perhaps one that we might look at in future issues in our last program. Concerning medical care, real briefly, I'd note that the Public Health Service at one time was supposed to stop, had the Land Claims Act been passed as it originally provided in one of the early bills, would have been no continuing public health care. But since the federal government did not pay nearly the market value for the land which it purchased from Alaska Natives, basically what we see is Public Health Service is a partial and continuing payment on the lands of Alaska which were bought from us at far less than market value. Manilok was started as a non-profit corporation, regional counterpart to NANA Corporation, and it shares in health care service and delivery within the NANA region. It's a regionally controlled, primarily non-Native employed program, but the important thing to note is that the direction is set by the Native community within the constraints of the Public Health Service grants. Its basis is the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act of 1975, I believe. Finally, we should note the regional control provided by the Northwest Alaska Native Association, forerunner of NANA Regional Corporation. They were that was a primary organization in this region which saw through the passage of the Land Claims Act and was dissolved, and NANA Corporation has inherited its role in conjunction with Manilok. I think I've got less than 30 seconds of programming. I've appreciated your attention. There are some excellent questions there. And we'll discuss at more length, hopefully, some of these issues when we deal with the future issues of the NANA region, the last program. Next week's program will deal with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act solely. And I hope that what we'll do is just highlight how the act was passed, the terms of the settlement, what was bought, what was sold, and how it affected the NANA region specifically. Thank you for your time and your attention, and I hope you have a good evening. We'll see you next week, Tuesday, 4 to 5 p.m.
Everyone to know that when you're feeling down or misunderstood, a little crack can do you good. Clear the air, cheer your mood. A little crack can do you good. Boo, wah, wah, sap, sap. Boo, wah, wah, sap, sap. Boo, wah, wah, sap, sap. Oh, a little crack can do you good.
I got a great big box of popcorn here. Let's go to the park and eat it.
Oh, sure, right. Kid. That's great. Well, golly. Well, wow. Kid, you're nice for a shrimp. You
popcorn.
Know that?
C. Cap. C.